If you will hang with me tonight for this, I told you I'd do one session on the Trinity, and we did. And tonight I'm going to do one session on the Incarnation. And anyone that's ever studied either subject would say, you know, it's like taking a cup of water out of the ocean and thinking you've made a difference. Both of these subjects are difficult. I wanted you to at least to get into a little bit of the discussion, so that the next week we meet, I will get back into the sequence of church history, and so then you could possibly appreciate better those issues and some of those councils and the things that arise surrounding Trinity and Incarnation. At Nicaea in 325, when Constantine legalized Christianity, at that council, the deity of Christ was the major issue. That's what they were trying, that Jesus and the Father are of the same substance, homo ousios. Ousia is the word for being, same being. 450 A.D., which is number two there, the Chalcedonian Council of Chalcedonia of A.D. 450. You need to put the 450 in there. I left it off. So 125 years later, at the Council of Chalcedon, the issue is, was Jesus a man? And we know that a lot of the challenges made to Christianity coming out of Gnosticism said that Jesus couldn't have had really a human body because the body is evil. And he only appeared to have a body, or God couldn't become flesh, so Jesus was an adopted Messiah, meaning adopted him at his baptism, and he dies a man, he doesn't die as the God-man. So there are several isms, Nestorianism, Apollinarianism, and more than I can count. I'll give you a handout next time of all of those groups that came up. Arius was the guy that said that Jesus wasn't really God. He was a lesser God. He was begotten and he was made, and there was a time when he was not. So Arius, as Danny was coming in, he had been reading some on Arius. He got excommunicated three times, one time after his death. You know, they decide 50 years after he died, they're going to excommunicate him again. And Danny said, I don't know how they got that communication to God, and says, I'm not sure whether you put him on the right side of the pond or not, but hey, we've decided he ain't with us anymore. See, he was, under Constantine, he was excommunicated, and under Constantius, who took over after Constantine, who was an Arian persuasion, when he took over leadership, he reinstated him. And then after he died, the church decided that Arianism was wrong, and so they excommunicated him. So anyhow, it's pretty bad when they want to spit on your grave, you know, dig you up and burn your bones and do whatever and that sort of thing. Okay. Incarnate means body, to have a body. God is not body. God doesn't have a body, because if he does, it would confine him to what?
The natural realm.
Natural realm, or to a place and space, right? If you're embodied, then there's a place where you can be and not be. And God being, what's one of those omni words? Omnipresent. For God to be omnipresent, he has to be bodiless. He can be everywhere and at the same time. Okay. Now, incarnate means, in the incarnation, it's just that God becomes flesh and dwells among us. Okay. And we'll go through this, and then I'll have comments at the end. Okay. Statement number one there. Jesus the Messiah, that's what the word Christ means. Jesus the Messiah is God's Son. Jesus Christ is God the Son. Jesus Christ is God. Now, do those three sentences say the same thing?
You're asking, do they say the same thing?
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll get back to the Clinton years of is, but there's an is of predication and an is of identity. Jesus Christ is God. That's an is of identity. Jesus and God are the same. Jesus is God the Son. Now, when we say Jesus the Messiah is God, can we turn around and say that God is Jesus? When we say Jesus is God, is he a infinite or a finite expression?
Which he?
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
It's a finite expression, is it not? I mean, when you see Jesus, he is God, but when you see Jesus, do you see all of God? You certainly don't see God in his original being, his not incarnate state, not bodied state. Jesus is a finite expression of God because he's in a finite world. And we can't embrace anything more than that. So it is fair to say Jesus is God, but he's not the full expression of God, not that he's not deity and that sort of thing. Don't get that. But the expression is not the fullness. You understand? The expression is a limited expression. Now, Jesus Christ is God the Son. How is that different than saying Jesus Christ is God? What are we trying to communicate when we say Jesus Christ is God the Son? Second part of the Trinity, right? Okay, that's what we're trying to say. And now we got to get some things on the table and so we go down, and as I mentioned at Chalcedon, let's read what they finally said about Jesus who came into the world, whether he was man, whether he was God, whether he had a body, whether he only appeared to have a body, on it went. Okay, here's their statement. We unanimously reached, and I typed it, I think it's teach, instead of reach, put a T there. We unanimously teach that we should confess that our Lord Jesus Christ is one and the same Son, the same perfect in Godhead, the same perfect in manhood, truly God and truly man. Now, that phrase, truly God and truly man, is a famous expression of the Chalcedonian statement, that Jesus was truly God and truly man. Like us in all things except sin. Where do they get this "like us in all things" from the scripture? Why is that important as a phrase? And where do we find that in scripture? Jesus was what? And likening to us. What the scripture said? Jesus was blank likening to us. Hebrews. Jesus was in all ways tempted like unto us. You know, where he says Jesus took on flesh and blood and lived and in all ways like unto us was tempted. Am I quoting that correctly? Hebrews things, okay. It says here, since the children share in flesh and blood, he himself partook of the same nature, and that through death he might destroy him who has the power of death and deliver those who have fear of death are subject to bondage. So that he might become merciful and high priest in the service of God to make expiation for the sins of the people, for because he himself has suffered and been tempted, He's able to help those who are tempted. And there's another statement. Where he says, and like, maybe it's four. Hang on. I don't see it right now. He was there's another place in Hebrews where it makes the exact statement. He's like us in all ways and tempted in all ways, likened unto us. I thought it was right there in two. Okay. I won't look for it anymore, but okay. But the truly God, truly man, like us in all things, comes out of Hebrews. Begotten of the Father comes out of where? John 3:16. Before all ages, as regard the Godhead, before all ages means that he is pre-existent. And in the last days, the same for us and for our salvation, begotten of the Virgin Mary. Now, what they're pressing here is deity and his humanity. Now, incarnation calls forth an incoherent objection, meaning this is an incoherent statement. When we say it's incoherent, what do we say? Okay, it is inconsistent. It's a contradiction. It doesn't meet with reasonable thinking. Saying someone is fully God and fully man is a contradiction. Why would that be a contradiction? Right. What would be an aspect of the meaning of to be God? What would be an aspect of God that you would say that whoever is fully God would have to have that aspect? Okay. Created? Uncreated? Okay, so you're saying Jesus was uncreated and created. If you say he is fully God, he's uncreated. If he's fully man, he's created. And so you have a logical contradiction, fully God, fully man being, okay. As God, he would be uncreated and all powerful. As a man, he would be created and finite in his power. So Jesus was both fully God and fully man. Now we're up against it in terms of thinking through how this works. Okay. And our creed is pretty strong. Fully God, fully man. Now, see, why would they want to say truly man? Because there was a movement called Docetism from the Greek word that is to appear. And they said Jesus wasn't really a man, he only appeared to be a man. But Jesus got hungry. He got thirsty. You know, he bled when they stuck him and beat him and that sort of thing. And against the ism of Docetism, which was saying he only appeared to have a body, he really didn't have one. They were saying he truly had flesh. Now, under number three, the incoherence objection, we are talking about two distinct unmingled natures, but is a single person. Now, this is the same language we use for Trinity, right? Three distinct entities, but one single Godhead. Okay, it's the same kind of language. We can say with respect to his humanity, he was created, right? The flesh he took on was created. With respect to his divinity, he was uncreated. He always was divine in part of the Godhead. And in response to this, I say, this sounds good, but stresses the division and not the unity. Once we drop the respect clause, we're back where we started. He was created and uncreated. Now, go to statement number four. The argument is that if Jesus, the Messiah, is fully God and fully human, then he must have all the properties required for divinity and for humanity. Would you agree or disagree with this sentence? Okay. Can you say that a property of being human would be that you're born on the earth? What if you were a pregnant woman in a spaceship flying around in the atmosphere? Would you be born on the earth?
All humans were aware of and been born on the earth.
But somebody in space station could have a baby, and you could have a human being that wasn't born on the earth, right? Okay. And this is just a philosophical way of saying, be careful how you make absolute statements, because I can find a way to say not all humans were, it's not a requirement to be human that you're born on the earth. You can be human if you're in a spacecraft, okay, or on the moon. For that matter, you know. Now, here's a statement. The point being is, if Jesus is truly God and truly man, is it required that he possess all the qualities of being human at the same time he possesses all the qualities of being divine? That's the tension of his incarnation. And I'm hoping tonight that you're all going to give me insight for the sermon for Sunday, because I'm really wrestling with Jesus as God the Son walking around on the earth, setting out to accomplish his mission. I don't want to usurp what I'm going to do Sunday, but How does this work? The church fathers taught that he had a human will. He had a divine will. He had a human mind. He had a divine mind. Now, in the Chalcedonian Creed, it says, That's not the one. I can't get the. That's not all the creed, but anyhow. Here, let me get back to what I was going to say. Okay. Now. We're saying, under number three here, there are two distinct natures of God and man, unmingled natures, meaning that the God nature didn't overpower the man nature. Okay, the point is, Jesus lives without sin, even though he lived in had a body and lived as we do. Now, if in that being God-man, we could say it's easy for him to deal with sin because God nature could overpower the human nature. Okay. And so the church really wrestled with the fact that these were two distinct natures within himself. Just like there are three distinct entities within the Godhead, they are distinct, but they're unified. And that's the same kind of language we're trying to get with the incarnation. Let me go on and get some more on the table. Okay, statement number five. A common human property common is the operative word there, versus an essential human property. A common human property would be we all were born on the earth. Is it essential? No, because you can be, as we said, you can be born on the moon or whatever and still be an earthling. Are humans purely biological creatures? And the answer is, does our mind body, we have a body, we have a mind body dualism, and the fact that we have an immaterial soul place us outside the domain of empirical natural sciences? Meaning, I can study the genetic makeup of my cattle and I can make changes in the structure of my cattle by that manipulation of natural science, okay? But as humans, are we not more than a smart animal? We don't see, my cows don't have a soul. They're not concerned about what's going to happen to them when they die. They don't question where they came from or where they're going. It's just where's the next blade of grass, okay? Now, so when we talk about what it meant for Jesus to be human, what are the essential qualities of being human? Now, we're going to keep trying to get at this, okay? Now go to statement number 6. In every way, he was like unto us. That's a quote from Hebrews. Meaning, there was a divine soul in a human body. We have to be careful that we do not stress his divinity at the expense of his humanity. Because he can't be in every way like us if we overstress his divinity at the expense of his humanity. As he possesses not only a human body, but also a human mind. Now, when we see how these two things interacted with each other, that classic statement, Matthew 24 and Mark 13, they asked Jesus, when would all these things take place, when he was talking about the temple will be destroyed and the moon will be turned to blood and the sky will start falling and the end of the time would be coming. And they asked him, when would this be? When are these things going to happen? And his answer was, he did not know. No one knows but the Father. Now, what does that seem to do to the divine quality of omniscience? All knowing. Okay. All right. All right. He didn't have it. Seems to be at that point. But you remember whenever he called, when he called Andrew and he went back to get his brother Nathaniel and he brought him to him. You remember what Jesus said to him? I saw you standing under the fig tree when your brother came to get you. And he believed in him immediately. Of course, Jesus wasn't that. I mean, he went back to get him and he said, when he found you, you were standing under the fig tree. And he said, whoa. How'd you know that? Now, at that point, his omniscience seems to be working. Over here, he says, I don't know the hour. Now, I think there's an interpretation issue there that you have to try to work with. He is saying, in saying, I don't know when the second coming is going to be, it's not saying he doesn't know. It's saying that it's a need to know basis kind of thing.
How do you know it depends on, we have free will, and so maybe certain things have to happen first, and so you can't say when time is, because free will is changing that time constantly.
And it is, but most people would say God's foreknowledge would be able to see all those plays happening and know when everything would climax. But the point there is when Jesus said only the Father knows, that's a Godhead decision. It isn't, I'm God the Son. I don't get to call that shot. It's called in the unity of the Godhead. And so the Son can't make the choice about when the second coming is going to come in absence of the other two parts of the Trinity. See, that's a Godhead decision. It's not a decision he makes. And I like to think of it better that way. I find multiple places where Jesus' omniscience is more than active. A woman who with the issue of blood, she touched him. He knew she touched him. Whenever he would be with a group of people and they were murmuring among themselves, or he said, you were asking, they were questioning in their own mind, and he would answer their questions. I mean, there are many occasions where that is there. All right, now, a classic response to all of this, how can he be fully God and fully man? Some people say that he laying it down is go to Philippians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians. Go to Philippians. All right. In chapter 2, verse 5, Paul says to the Philippians, have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in the Messiah Jesus, who, verse 6, though he was in the form of God, did not count what? Equality with God, a thing to be grasped. So is he part of the Godhead? Is he divine? Equal with God pretty much takes care of it, doesn't it? Now here, let me preface what I'm going to say just a little bit more, because it's important to do so. When you read something in the Greek text and you are a Greek scholar, you can read the Gospel of Mark and say, this sounds like a dumb fisherman. You know, it's just like you can listen to a conversation and people who want to show off their education can show off their education with words you can't spell or maybe define, right? Okay. When you read the Gospel of Mark, it was written in very simple, common language Greek, Koine, it's called. It's the language of Greek of the common man. Shakespearean Greek, you know, well, he wasn't a Greek, he was an Englishman. But anyhow, the arts, the Greeks, the Greek of the theater, the Greek of the upper class, was an entirely different Greek in terms of choice of words. And so you can read something and tell a guy's education just from where his language is. Okay. Now, when you're reading Paul and you get up to this verse right here, all of a sudden, verse 5 through 11, it's very easy to recognize that Paul didn't write this part. It's not the similar style of Paul. Choice of words is a little different. And it's rhythmic, meaning that it was composed for repetition. Now, so what is projected is, this is a confessional statement about Jesus that the church had that Paul picked up and put into his writing. It'd be like a hymn. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound, saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. You know, see the rhythm, the rhyme, all of that stuff that's there. Well, so this was a statement of the church. It's not just a statement of Paul. It's a hymn of the church. Colossians, is a similar, where it says, he's the image of the invisible God, firstborn of all creation. For him, all things were created, in heaven on earth, visible and invisible, or thrones or dominion, principalities or authority. When you go to Colossians, that's another hymn he picked up, or another. So when we get to this statement that's being made here, it's a statement of the church that had been, because Paul is writing 20 years after the resurrection of Jesus. So this is a statement the church had solidly formed. Okay, verse 5. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself. And the word there is kenosis, K-E-N-O-S-I-S. Okay, emptied. Okay. And so the kenotic theory is that even though he was in equality with God, he emptied himself and took the form of a servant. Now, the NIV will let you know anytime there's a controversy, because it will solve the controversy for you. And what did NIV write at this point? He didn't empty himself, he what? Made himself nothing. How is that a lighter statement than he emptied himself? Okay. Yeah. It is. I got the power to whoop you, but I'm not going to whoop you. Okay. I'm just going to make you, let you think that you're, I'm scared of you or something. Okay. Now, the point being is the kenotic theory, the kenosis theory, Jesus emptied himself. What did he empty himself of? Did he empty himself of his deity to robe himself with flesh? Because especially somewhere along in the 1700s, this became a very, very strong way of explaining the incarnation. That even though that Jesus was the second part of the Godhead, he emptied himself. But if he emptied himself, is he no longer divine? And so he's not truly God, because he emptied himself of his godness.
Well, why don't the people jump to the conclusion that he's simply self-limiting himself, the same as God self-limits himself by just not bringing hell down on us right now?
Yeah. Okay. That is another concept. Self-limitation. There are times when he would limit his God powers. When Pilate was examining Jesus and Jesus was responding to Pilate and Pilate or not responding to Pilate and Pilate says, "Hey, dude, you realize I got the power over you?" And what was Jesus' response about who has the power?
You only have what the Father gives you.
And what kind of power have I got? I can call.
Legions.
I can call for legions of angels. And, you know, I mean, you couldn't stand with one of them, but legions, 1,000? You know, they say 12 legions of angels or something there, but anyhow. Okay, the point being is, Was he disrobed of his divinity? I mean, the point of Jesus going to the cross as a willing servant is that it wasn't that he didn't have the divine power to stop that process. He had it but didn't exercise it. And that's a powerful statement. He said, "I can call for the angels. We can end this right now." Go ahead.
You almost have to have the self-limited. I mean, that's got to be a quality in it, because otherwise, who else limited him? I mean, it was a voluntary thing,
right?
Laying down whatever he laid down.
And if he's using what Jesus did as an example to the Philippian people, what example are we supposed to we're supposed to follow. We're supposed to empty ourselves. We don't empty ourselves of our humanity. We still are human, but what do? We empty ourselves of the right to be right.
Our freedom.
Yeah. But the point being is, he's saying, just as Jesus self-limited himself, it's just as Jesus, there is a status and a privilege to being God, is there not? Okay. And what did Jesus become? Now, it is more, you know, even though that kenosis does mean emptying, and NIV, because of all the words that passed around about it, have said, made himself nothing. That's what he did. He had the status and privilege of equality with God, and he made himself nothing. Meaning, not that he was a nothing without power, but that he didn't exercise the privilege of the Godhead, where he doesn't take no from anybody. Exercising the power that he had. He had the power. When he stood up in the boat in the storm, did he have the power? I mean, that's a creation power where you can stand up and say, be still. And it stops. I mean, you know, he had, whenever he multiplied the fishes and the loaves, the omnipresence, he confined himself within the limits of his body. If he wanted to go to Jerusalem, he had to take the body with him. You know, that is a self-limiting. But the principle of this here is that Jesus didn't cease to be God while he was living on the earth. Because you can't.
And you also get in the post-resurrection that he didn't limit himself quite as much in that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, with the two men on the road to Emmaus, they were sitting at table with him, and as soon as he picked up the bread and broke it, he was no longer in their midst. He would be with the disciples, and then he would be out of their midst, and you know, the doors locked behind them, and he'd appear among them, and he'd go out, and that to me is more of a picture of what possibly we might have in our resurrected bodies. We would have a body of identity. As soon as Jesus appeared, they knew who he was, but yet he wasn't confined. And he could, you know, he wasn't a spatial limit kind of thing. And when we go to the next life, I think that is reflective of how possibly that may work differently. Okay. We won't have to put up with our arthritic joints and our tired old bodies, you know, it'd be different. Okay. Now, so the question of emptying and making himself a servant. See, the Godhead had a concept, had a plan they wanted to achieve. Making free moral agents that could choose the good instead of the evil and promoting more good. And at a price, and he comes to redeem the plan, and that's all part of the Godhead. You know, when Jesus, I think it's always important to remember that when Jesus said he came to do the will of the Father, he came to do the will of the Godhead. It's not a subordinate, superior relationship. He said, I'm in submission to the will of the Godhead. But we decided together how we do this. And that's one of the things that we're talking about Sunday is when Jesus was up against it. I mean, you're talking about, he had this humongous project coming into the world of humanity, and,
he was 180 degrees out of phase.
Yes, they were, and he had to correct that, and it's tough to show people God who think they know God. And he had to do that. That was his project. But I don't want to. Okay.
You afraid him won't come on Sunday?
Well, you know, what happens to me is that if I cook it too long, then I'm not excited about it. You know, I generally spend about 4 hours on Saturday evening, usually from 8 till midnight. I work on the sermon all week long. I'm thinking about it and trying to figure out where I'm going and what's the point and all that business. But on Saturday night, I like to see all the pieces start coming together. And, you know, Sunday's message, I thought, really came together well in terms of what I was trying to accomplish. And sometimes that doesn't happen until, you know, everybody's in the bed and it's late at night and I'm really saying, okay, this is all the pieces. Now, how does that fit? And sometimes it just locks into place for me that way. And I got to do it. So I get up in the morning. I'm all excited about what I finished last night. Well, if I cook it too early, then I'm not excited about it. If I discover what I want to say on Tuesday, it's hard for me to not go ahead and talk about it now. Okay. Now, he lived under the limitation of his humanity. Like if he wanted to go from Galilee to Jerusalem, he walked and got tired. Now, we have to wrestle with some issues. In the early part of Mark, I was reading yesterday and just trying to get a picture of how Jesus started his ministry out. And he performed a few miracles and they got everybody excited, and then he would go off to pray. And they go find him. And says, man, what? The town's crawling with people everywhere, and here you are out here in the wilderness. It's, you know, we get back over here and take care of all these people. Now, how does Jesus have a need to pray? Okay. Is that simply an example thing? Or is there part of this fully God, fully man, trying to make sure how I not, well, let me go ahead and tell you, y'all come regularly, but I got to deal with the fact that he goes into the temptation. And the whole issue there is how you going to do your ministry? You're going to jump off the temple? You're going to take care of yourself? You're going to do all that stuff going on? And you're saying, well, dadgummit, he knew what he was going to do. But is there a tension within his God-man structure? I mean, who among us wants to beat theirself with a hammer? I mean, he's got a tough road to look at. And is there the humanity part of himself that wrestles with the God part of himself over where we're going and how we're going to accomplish it? These are the questions that we're trying to wrestle with. And in that sense, he is like unto us. Well, we're trying to say, are we going to let the God part of us or the man part of us rule? Are we going to submit? You know, are we going to wrestle through that? You know, and so that dimension of Jesus is, boy, it's a mystery. And it, we know that Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, and for 30 years he worked as a builder. He started out as a baby and he grew up. There was the human development side of Jesus that went through a process. Okay. And then at the same time, there was a divine self-consciousness about his own identity. He knew who he was when he was 8 years old in the temple, or 12, you know, when he was 12 there in the temple. And, okay.
Yeah. Because a 2-day-old doesn't even.
Yeah, and they're not conscious.
Even aware of,
yeah,
themselves.
Their own. Yes, and I think. Well.
I don't want to get you off on that.
No, but I mean, these are the kinds, you know, you can't say that, well, you can say, but it presents problems that Jesus clothes himself with this body that he has to wait to grow through a natural process because it's a real natural body. And so he waits for that to grow and then breaks forth in his ministry. And like I said, we have glimpses that at least like when he was 12, he said, I must be about my father's business. Okay. And he baffled the people he was talking with then. So he certainly had that divine consciousness as well as his physical life. Now, okay. All right. What we've done tonight is simply tried to say that the fully God, fully man, part of the incarnation is as much a mystery in terms of how it works. Because the church, you know, like I told you, they wrestled over, well, he just, you know, the divine part had to be so much stronger than the human part. There's no battle. There's no fight or whatever. But you know, when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, praying. Yeah. And he sweat drops of blood. That the physical side of him was yearning and straining for what the divine consciousness was telling him was happening and trying to, you know, embrace that and not flee from it. Because once again, having the power to walk away from it and not is a tremendous power. He could just walk away from it all and just say, no way, not doing this. Okay. And yet, so it gives that us that encouragement that in always likening to us, he walked through our experience that he's trying to get us to let him now help us with. And we can't ever hope to comprehend it all, but we can appreciate it, that there was that struggle within him. Okay. We're going to get back into our sequence of church history because we're going to leave Nicaea, and over the next 100 years, they're still going to be wrestling with the identity of Christ, and we'll go on with our church history study. But I want you to at least appreciate there's a lot of questions absorbed in. People can answer the question, Jesus is Son of God and born of the Virgin Mary, but how in the world is that, what does that mean, and how does that work? There's a lot more that we don't know than we know. Okay.